The book of Mishlei poses certain philosophical problems. Now, I know philosophy is not popular in the Jewish world, in today's current Jewish world, but for a long period of time it was very popular. And the greatest men of Israel were occupied with philosophical difficulties which exist. One of the great difficulties which exists, and is discussed in Mishlei at length, is the nature of evil. What does it mean to be a Rosha? What is Ra? Things that are bad, evil. So the first problem is, how can evil exist at all if everything in the world emanates kaviyochel from the Rabbono Shel Olam, from God? And by definition, God is good. So what happened here? How did evil ever come into the world, a world that is created by a God who is good? So unless we posit, chas v'chalila, that God is not good, which is the idea of paganism, by the way. Entire idea of paganism is that Zeus and Jupiter and all the guys up there are really bad people. They steal other people's wives, they kill, they do things at random, they're jealous of each other. In other words, paganism took all of the bad traits of human beings and imposed them on their gods. And the reason that they did that, because that made the world somehow more rational. You could understand the world if Zeus is jealous, and seduces other people's wives, so then we understand why that happens in the world. And the gods kill each other, ambush each other, punish each other, so then that's the world. So to a great extent, it's an exculpatory clause that comes to exclude any human weaknesses because we are like the gods. Opposite to that idea, see, the Rambam says the basis of all averas is avodah zarah. Everything hinges on avodah zarah. So we think because avodah zarah means bowing down to a statue, so it doesn't apply to us. But what the Rambam means is a much deeper idea, that the basis of all averas is the understanding of the world the way avodah zarah understands the world. So opposite to this idea is the idea of Judaism that God is good. Atov ha'meitiv lakol. Nebon Shalom is Molei Chesed, Rachum v'Chanun, Erech Apayim, Rav Chesed v'Emes, Noseh Chesed la'alofim. So if God is so good, how come the world is so bad? I'm sure that troubled you this morning waiting for the pancakes. How come? And so Jewish philosophers, based on the ideas in Mishlei, because Shlomo comes to define evil, have grappled with the problem. I think it's one of the ironies of our time is that really the Jewish people are not occupied with serious thoughts about Judaism. It's all superficial. The Gaon of Vilna says, "Be'achris Ayomin," that at the end of days, before the Messianic era, he says, "Hakol shitchias." It's all only superficial. So superficial, we're occupied with dress, and we're occupied with the length of wigs, and we're occupied with the secularists are occupied with the Talmud. All of these things are important, but the essence of Judaism is never discussed anymore. Maybe it has to be that way, because otherwise, in our time, the philosophic questions are so difficult that one could lose one's faith by it. The Gaon says that, by the way, even though the Gaon is the great fan of the Rambam, he says that the Rambam made a mistake in delving in popularizing philosophy because of the fact that people got lost because of the philosophy and lost their faith. I mentioned it in one of the previous lectures here, that the Chofetz Chaim felt that a simple, plain Jew who never, is never in the great spheres of intellect or spirituality, that's the kind of person that we want. Because that's really our time. But nevertheless, we have another 45 minutes to fill here. So we're going to discuss this great idea of evil. And evil has a companion to it, that Shlomo HaMelech, not only in Mishlei, but in Koheles, is the partner. The partner to evil here is Momon, is wealth. Osher Shomur Ra Libolov. Wealth that a person has brings evil to its owner. So here we have another, we're going to get back to the first philosophical problem of evil, but here we have another problem, right? Does Judaism preach poverty? We don't find that anywhere in the world. We don't find that in Jewish sources. Though Chazal do say, Yoe aniusol Yisrael, Jews do better in poverty than they do in affluence. Because again, this concept is that affluence, great wealth, brings with it evil. And so we have here these parameters of the discussion. We say a brocha in the morning, in davening, after Baruch Hu, Yotzer Or Uvorei Choshech, Ose Shalom Uvoreis Hakol. Yotzer Or, God created light, Uvorei Choshech. And out of it he created darkness. Ose Shalom, somehow he harmonized the two. Uvorei Hakol, and he created everything. Oh, we say that bracha, but that's not the original bracha. In the Talmud, in brachas, the bracha is Yotzer Or Uvorei Ra. God created evil. Oseh Shalom, he makes some sort of harmony between the goodness represented by light and the evil which exists. Uvorei Hakol, and through that everything is created. So the rabbis dropped the Borei Ra part, and they just said Borei Choshech. But you're supposed to understand that Choshech is not the symbol of nighttime, because when it's night here, it's day somewhere else on the earth. The earth is never shrouded in darkness completely. That the idea of darkness is evil. And the Torah itself prescribes it by saying, Ki yetzer lev ha'adam ra minurav, God said. Man's inclination from his earliest time is to be an evil person. So then what did God do here? Again, if man's earliest inclination is to be bad, to be evil, then how can you blame him, right? So you have... you have your two-year-old child, that slugs his three-month-old brother. So you don't take the kid and bring him to the police station and book him for assault. Because he's 2 years old. We expect that behavior. That's Yetzer Lev Adam Ra Minurav. We're narcissistic, we're selfish, and we express it. Civilizing a child is somehow to introduce the Yetzer HaTov, the goodness, into a person to counteract the evil. And the Gemara says that we are always playing a catch-up game, because the Yetzer HaTov does not come into women till they're 12 and does not come into men till they're 13. Meanwhile, the Yetzer HaRa has got a 12, 13 year head start on it. It was there from the beginning. And that's why it's so difficult to overcome it. So what it got, what is this idea? How did it happen? And again, on this, Jewish philosophers over the ages have struggled with the problem. Because it's an essential problem. And I want to deal with two theories. One advanced by the Rambam and one advanced by the Ramchal, by Rav Moshe Chaim Litzatel, as to the ideas of evil. The Rambam, his basic pillar of faith is freedom of choice. And freedom of choice outweighs everything in life. And that was the gift that God gave us. Because without freedom of choice, there cannot be reward, there cannot be punishment, there cannot be an advancement in the world, there would be no creativity, there would be nothing. We would all be robots. The Gemara says, for instance, that in the time of Ezra, you know, we'll have to understand this again in a metaphoric sense, what the Gemara means. The Gemara says in the time of Ezra, the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, they got hold of the Yetzer HaRa. They grabbed him. And they put out one of his eyes, is the expression in the Gemara. They weakened him. So that in the Second Temple, Jews were not prone to paganism. They were exposed to Greek culture. They wanted to be, but they didn't really believe in that nonsense. Whereas in the First Temple, they were absolute pagans. They were so dominated by the society of paganism that surrounded them that they worshipped idols. And they themselves were pagans. In the Second Temple, that was not the case. The problems in the Second Temple were far different. So the Gemara says, if they had the Yetzer HaRa in their hands, and they put out one of his eyes, why didn't he put out his other eye and we'd get rid of him completely? So the Gemara says, well, they tried that. And the moment they put out his other eye, meaning the Yetzer HaRa was now defunct, was out of business, he said the hens stopped laying eggs. The world ended. Because if there's no Yetzer HaRa, then nothing happens. So therefore they prayed, and the Yetzer HaRa got one eye back. And that is what makes the world go round. Right? If it wouldn't be for Yetzer HaRa, we would never have children. And there would, we'd never invent things. And when the Yetzer HaRa is what drives it. It's called, you know, there's an entire section of the newspaper called the business section, which is based on the Yetzer HaRa. And if that isn't enough, then there's a sports section. And then there's the op-ed pages, you know. The weather is about the only thing that the Yetzer HaRa doesn't cover in the paper, right? But there wouldn't be any, what news would there be, right? Everybody's sitting and learning. Everybody is doing good. Nobody's bothering anybody. It's a wonderful situation. That doesn't sell newspapers. So the Rambam says that in order to fulfill the mission of human beings, because God created us with a mission, and the mission is to improve the world, L'saken olam b'malchus shakai, to improve the world, the kingdom of God, meaning that it should have godliness within it. So that requires the Yetzer HaRa. Because there has to be this freedom of choice. And without the freedom of choice, there's no impetus to go ahead. And freedom of choice posits that there has to be the Yetzer Hara. And therefore, that's why in the world, evil can exist, and God will not interfere with evil. That is his position. So God will let the Holocaust happen, and he'll let Darfur happen, and he'll let Hamas happen. Because that freedom of choice is so sacrosanct, it's the essence of creation. The Koach HaBchira. And he says that's the interpretation in the Chumash Bereishis of the story of Adam HaRishon and Chava, and then of Cain and Hevel. So you see there was a Koach HaBchira by Adam HaRishon even before he ate from the Eitz Hadas. Even before he ate the forbidden fruit. Because if he had no choice, how could he have even eaten from the forbidden fruit? So it's created in the person innately. It's part of our DNA. The moment it's created, the moment we're created, it's created with us. That freedom of choice. Do whatever you want. And therefore, that's why evil exists. And evil, even though in essence it may not be a positive thing, it leads to a positive thing because it reinforces our ability to make choices. Our ability to make choices enhances the world, allows technology, allows all sorts of great things to occur. It's one of the most interesting, ironic things is that most of the advances in technology in the history of the world are because of wars. Medicine advances because of wars. And the computers, everything that we have is because of the fact that there are wars. So you got to figure out a better way to kill the other guy, which is not a nice thing, but the byproduct, so to speak. The race to the moon. We didn't. If Russia never would have put a Sputnik up, we wouldn't be interested in it. But they did it, so we have to do it better. Meanwhile, there are 1,000 byproducts from the space program. Even if the space program itself may not be useful, but the byproducts from it have changed our lives. So that's the Rambam's position. Not everybody agrees with him. Not everybody likes that. Because of the fact that it does not answer the original question that I posed to you so brilliantly. If God is good, then how does evil come in? You're telling me what is the purpose of evil. I'm asking you, how did evil come into the world? And that's what God told Cain. Right, the incentive says, if you're good, you'll be able to bear everything that happens in the world. Vimlo seitiv, and you don't want to do good, la pesachatos rovets. There's plenty of evil out there. You can do whatever you want. So this brings us to the opinion of the Ramchal, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lutzato. The Ramchal is famous for the Mesilas Yeshorim, for his book, The Path of the Righteous. Ramchal himself has a very difficult lifetime. He's a genius, which is a problem immediately. If you don't believe, you know, just ask me. The Ramchal is born in Italy. By the time he's 20 years old, he's a great Talmudic scholar. He has smicha. But not only that, he is a Kabbalist, spiritualist. And not only that, but he practices Kabbalah, so to speak. He gives out amulets, all sorts of things. He's only 20 years old. And he's a very different person. He doesn't have a beard. He writes plays. He's not, you know, he's not Mayor Shorim squared. And Jews don't like people who are different, find them hard to digest. And therefore, he's expelled from Italy, driven away. And not only driven away, every place that he tries to settle in Provence and then later in France, there are emissaries from the Italian rabbis that catch up to him and tell the rabbis in that town, listen, drive this guy out. And he finally ends up in Holland, in Amsterdam. And he's a lens grinder. That's how he makes his living. He's a lens grinder. And he writes, he has many, many books. Monsieur Yesharim is one of them. Derech Hashem, Derech Tunos, Das Tunos. He has many books. And he has Kabbalistic books. Rabbi Yaakov Emden Getzai, who took no prisoners, and who lived at a time when they searched for people that had the tendencies to support Shabtai Tzvi, and who warred with the whole world, also has this war with the Ramchal, with Rabbi Meisher Chaim Litzato. And Ramchal finally has to leave Europe, and he comes to Eretz Yisrael, where he dies about 2 weeks after arriving, in a plague. And he's buried here in Tveria, in the cave that's reputed to be the burial place of Rabbi Akiva, that's also his burial place. He lived to be about 42. Very tragic life. So we would think that that's over. All of, you know, history to, you know, we wrote him off the pages. However, he was rehabilitated first by the Gaon of Vilna. The Gaon was a younger contemporary of his. The Gaon said that in the first 10 chapters of the Masilas Yesharim, there's not one extra word. He said a person who could write like that has divinity within him. And part of the heritage of the Gaon of Vilna was the Musar movement. And the Musar movement under Rabbi Saul Salanter and Rabbi Itzhak Petterberger and the other great Balei Musar in Lithuania in the 19th century made the Masilas Yesharim the cornerstone of Musar study. To such an extent that even in the Lithuanian yeshivas today, even though the Musar movement itself, unfortunately, is no longer present, but at least lip service is paid to study the Masilas Yesharim. Now, Ramchal is a philosopher as well. Not just a pietist, he's a philosopher as well. And he addresses this problem of where does evil come from? How does evil exist? And he, unlike the Rambam says evil is evil. He advances a theory that's called evil is imperfect good. Good that has not yet been perfected. And therefore, everything that emanates from heaven is good. But on the way down here, somehow it's affected by the atmosphere, by space, by whatever term we want to use, and that renders the perfect good into imperfect good. But it also says that all evil can somehow be perfected. That's the basic position here. Because since it's only imperfect good, then I can make it perfect. Like if you buy, one of those things that you're supposed to put together, you know, in the store. Right, I'm still recovering from the trauma of buying my first outdoor gym for the little kids. that you're supposed to put together. Only you got to be a rocket scientist just to figure out the instructions. And there's always a screw missing. Right? They never give you enough. So that's evil. Evil is the kid. Come on, I told you, this is pure genius. Evil is the kit of good, but it's got a screw missing. And you're here to somehow supply the screw, put it together. We're discussing the Ramchal, we're not discussing, you know, other variants. So he says, therefore, that's what the Gemara meant. Yotzer or vore ra, God created evil, meaning God gave you the kit. He gave you the thing that you're supposed to assemble. But it's not evil per se, it's imperfect good that you somehow are going to perfect. And therefore, he gives us a drive. He gives us a sexual drive. And you're supposed to perfect it through having children and a family and controlling it. He gives us a drive of competition. So, kinat sofrin tarbe chochma, and the competition amongst the wise, that so it increases wisdom. There's a competition on automobiles, and therefore, Toyota builds a better automobile than Chrysler. So that's the perfection of evil. Competition itself, oh, it's evil, right? Masigvul, you jump on other. But it's not evil, it's imperfect good, and what you do with it determines whether or not it is assembled correctly and whether it has that quality to it. And that's a very, very superficial analysis that I'm giving you of a very deep philosophic thought, but he develops it, and he explains Kabbalah in the same idea, because the Ari introduced in Kabbalah the idea that there are positive sparks, so to speak, nitzotzos, sparks that emanated from heaven at the moment of creation, the Big Bang. So in the Big Bang, all sorts of godly sparks were loosed in the universe. But they're covered by husks. What is called in Kabbalistic language a klipa, by a skin, by a cover. And our job is to uncover the klipa and redeem the sparks. So in Kabbalah, that's one of the ideas of the Jewish exile, is that the Jews had to be all over the world, and they had to see all the people, and they had to undergo everything, because these godly sparks are all over the world. And through Torah and mitzvahs and the energy and creativity of the Jews, we somehow remove the sparks from the husks and expose them to human benefit. If you'll think about it, the whole idea of atoms, which again Einstein proved that atoms exist, the whole idea of molecules and energy in atoms and all everything that fuels today's technological world is a great parallel to this idea of the sparks and the husks, etc. Because of the fact, if you can split the atom, so then you release its energy. So you release its energy. No one ever calls me. You release its energy. So then the spark came out of the husk, right? And now with this energy, you know, you can produce electricity, you can build a bomb, you can do it. Now it's up to you, whatever you want to do with it. But it's that concept that somehow you have to release it. So there is a spiritual energy in the world also, called the nitzotzos, the sparks. And we have to split the husk, we have to split that atom to release it so that somehow in the world godliness is increased. So that he describes that Kabbalistic idea, which they are reintroduced, and which is the basis in Chassidus. It's repeated very, very often. Again, one of the things in our world is that our concept of Chassidus is very superficial, even amongst Chassidim. Very superficial. So it became a matter of dress and how you davened and, you know, and all sorts of things. But Chassidus has it within a deep, deep philosophic, spiritual foundations. And that's what the main disagreement regarding it was philosophical, not only the question of the superficial part. And the Gaon's opposition to it was greatly philosophical, because he said that philosophy, as appealing as it is not Judaism. So we have this concept of imperfect good, which in Mishle is repeated over and over again. The idea that the Rosha can become a tzaddik, which is the concept of tshuva. How does tshuva help? The Gemara says, for instance, that the sins become merits for the person. It becomes about tshuva. So let's say he did 20 terrible things, right? Aleph and hay and everything else, right? Did terrible things. And now he's a Baal Tshuva, right? So good for him. How does that erase what happened before? So the concept is that the sins become merits simply because what was before is now transformed. Then it was imperfect good, and now somehow he has found a way to perfect that good and to bring it to a different level. I'm going to discuss in the practical idea, you know, that the victims of his evil, how does that straighten out? We're talking philosophically on the idea of evil itself. So Shlomo HaMelech says that in Mishle, hundreds of times almost, right? How evil can be transformed into good. And that's really our task, therefore. So when I spoke about piety last night, piety is to make the right choice originally. But after piety, there is a step in which we can correct past errors. And the correction of past errors itself will lead to a different level of piety. And that's a discussion in the Talmud, whether or not this level of piety is higher than the original level. The Gemara says, "B'mokum shabalei tshuva omdim, ein tzaddikim gemurim yecholim lamod." That in heaven, the Baal Tshuva is on a higher level than the one that was always perfect, because the one that was always perfect never was able to perfect the imperfect good. Never met it, so to speak. Whereas the Baal Tshuva has perfected, he's released some of the sparks from the husk that enclosed it. There's a famous legend. The Gaon of Vilna lived at the same time as the Dubner Magid, Rabbi Yaakov Krantz. And he would invite the Magid to come in the Aseres Yemei Tshuva to give him Musar. You know, it's hard to give Musar to the Gaon of Vilna. The Gaon of Vilna had a list of how many minutes during the year he wasted. The story is this, and his children wrote that his sister came to visit him, and he said to her, "I'd like to spend more time with you, but I don't have time now. In the midst of studying Torah," he said, "in the world to come, we'll have all eternity to talk to each other." So, you know, it's hard to give Musar to such a person, right? What are you going to tell him? So the Magid said to him as follows. He said, do you think that it's an accomplishment to be the Gaon of Vilna? You're sitting here in your study. You never go outside. You have no public responsibility. Everything is delivered to you. See, he said, das ist a Kunst. That's a trick. That's an accomplishment. He said, go out on the fish market in Vilna. Let's see if you're the Gaon. Jews have to go every day to buy and sell and do. Let's see then if you're a Gaon. So the legend is that the Gaon wept, but that the Gaon said to him, who says you have to be a Kunstmacher? Who says you have to make tricks in this world? Who says, you know, like, so the Gaon was not interested in that. But the idea of the Baal Tshuva rises above, higher. And then there's the other opinion in the Gemara, and you shall know there's always another opinion. That's one of the great things about Judaism, is there's always another opinion. Now, you can't follow all the opinions at one time, but you should be aware that there is another opinion. I heard it from Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, the son-in-law of Rabbi Soloveitchik. Rabbi Lichtenstein, got a PhD in English something or other from Harvard. And at the presentation, and he got his PhD, so his father-in-law asked him, what did you learn at Harvard? So he said, I learned that there's another opinion. So he said, well, if you learned that, then it was worth it. If that lesson is inculcated within you, that there can be another opinion, so then it's worth it. It's true by us too. So the other opinion is that the Baal Tshuva is in a lower level than the one who never sinned. It's interesting that the commentators say Noach is a tzaddik, right? Noach ish tzaddik tomi moyo bidaroso vesolakim is halech Noach. There's nobody in the Torah that gets this kind of a write-up. It's almost as good as Mishpacha magazine. You get such a write-up. The Torah, Yish Tzadik, Tomi Moya Bedoroso, Vesalakim Isalech Noach, right? And we make Ashim Blote from Noach. Noach is nothing. Nayochel Noach, you know, and then we don't count ourselves, B'nai Noach is the rest of the world, it's not us, etc. Bavaram, it doesn't say any of these things. By Moshe, it doesn't say any of these things. So the commentators say the greatness of Avraham is that for 52 years he worshipped idols. Then he came to be Avraham. So therefore, he's greater than, unless you fall, you can't rise. Noach is a tzaddik from the beginning, right? A tzaddik from the beginning. So then the first test, he fails. The whole world is destroyed. He can rebuild the world as he wishes to, and he doesn't. Because he never was tested. He never failed before. The idea that I mentioned yesterday that Shlomo introduces us to is that failure itself is a positive thing. Moshe Rabbeinu also, he has to escape, he has paro, all sorts of things happen to him before he becomes Moshe. David HaMelech is a shepherd, he's the least regarded of the brothers. So that's the idea of the perfection of events in the world, which to a great extent mitigates evil, turns evil into a productive idea. Shlomo says in Mishle, Sheva Yipol Tzadik Vakom, the righteous person will also fall seven times. But Vakom, he'll pick himself up. whereas the evil person stays down already. He doesn't try to pick himself up anymore. And that's one of the ideas regarding Klal Yisrael generally, is that out of all people in the world, we are certainly the most resilient. Just an appreciation of Eretz Yisrael, whichever, however we want to look at it, is that 60 years after the Holocaust, there is somehow a Jewish state with almost 6 million Jews in it, and that it's got it's second in the world in high tech, and it does all of these things, and it doesn't go off the page one of any of the newspapers. It's remarkable. We're down and out, right? Destroyed. And there are no comebacks in history. Nobody ever came back. So resilience is the great quality here. So Sheva Yipol Tzadik Vakon, the way to overcome evil is to get up afterwards. To be able to rise from it, which fits into this idea of the imperfection of good, which is translated somehow into evil. Now, Shlomo, I mentioned before, associates great wealth with evil. I shouldn't say with evil, with the ability to do evil. Balzac said his famous comment that behind every great fortune is a great crime. That can be an overstatement. There are exceptions always. But generally speaking, people of great wealth don't necessarily have a good life. In fact, probably if the statistics were taken, they have a very difficult life. I know a number of people of great wealth who are wonderful people, but they have bodyguards. They're afraid their children will be kidnapped. They live in a fortress. So if you think about it, is it chavez? Is it worth it? You never buy an airplane ticket on your own name. All sorts of things that we never think of, but which come with the territory. But worse than that, the Gemara says, Rebbe Mechabed Ashirim. Rebbe gave great honor to wealthy people. So the Mefarshim all ask why. First of all, Rebbe himself is a very, very wealthy person. But what does it mean that Rebbe Mechabed Ashirim, that he gave great honor to wealthy people? You know, he gave great honor to Talmidei Chachomim. He gave great honor to righteous people. He gave great honor to power. What does it mean to wealthy people? So all the Mefarshim say that Rebbe said wealth is one of the greatest opportunities that's given to people, because with it, an enormous amount of good can be done. There are millions of husks that can be taken away and sparks relieved. But it depends what a person does with wealth. Most people misuse wealth. They abuse it. Either because they indulge themselves or because they do silly things with it. Silly things with it. I remember I went many times with the Ponovich Arov, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, to collect money for the yeshiva when I was in Miami Beach. And we went to see a very wealthy person who was a noted philanthropist, but who gave to the wildest things, right? He dedicated a farm to raise greyhounds for the dog races. All sorts of things. You know, the IRS has a long list of charitable contributions. And not everything is there. So he went to see him, and I know the Rav asked him for what I thought was a sizable amount of money, but retrospect, not really. He asked him for $10,000, and so that was 40 years ago. So let's say today it's $80,000. Still wasn't money. And the man hemmed and hawed. So the Ponovizier Rav said to him, listen, he said, do you consider yourself a good businessman? He said, Rebbe, you see all the money that I made, you know, I always invested wisely and I owned a good, you know, he said, sure, I'm a good businessman. So he said, then why are you such an idiot, he said. You know, he says, I'm offering you Olam Haba for $80,000 and you're hesitating. I'm offering you eternity, you know, on the cheap. And you're hesitating. So he said, Rebbe, how do I know that you can deliver? He said to him. So the Ponovizier Rav, who was one smart Jew, he said, try me. Probiert. And he gave him the money. So it depends what you do with it. But the problem with it is, as Shlomo points out over and over again, is that most people misuse it, abuse it, don't understand why they have it. And eventually they think that it's kochi, and the Torah itself describes it, kochi ve'otzim yodi, osus olios achayel, I've said, look how smart I am, my industry, my efforts, look, I made it, you know, and therefore it's mine. And Shlomo points out to us the clear lesson that it's not yours. It doesn't belong to you. It's a trusteeship. You have, as long as a person is alive, then he deals with it. The Rav told me many times, he says, people think that, you know, a rich man's Gehenna. He says, what's the Gehenna? What's the hell of a rich man? He says that people think they stick him with a pitchfork and roast him over the fire and everything. Nothing. He said, the Gehenim is they show him what happens to his money after he's dead. What the kids do with it, what the government does with it, what the lawyers do with it, right? That's the Gehenim. Because he thinks that it's his. In Halacha, for instance, after a person passes away, so then he has absolutely no right to dispose of the money, right? Wills in Halacha have no effect. Because he's dead. So then the money is divided according to the way the Torah said you divide it. If you wanted to control your money, so to speak, so you have to do it when you're alive, right? Give it away now. The only way most people are afraid to do that. Probably for just cause, too. But that's the whole concept here. The whole concept of wealth is that it's a gift, a trusteeship given to us. And the question is, what do we do with it? Which goes back to the Rambam's idea of choice as being the origin. So money can be evil simply because of the choices that are made, the bad choices that are made. I think we have to see that in historic terms, this has probably been the most, we are living at a time when the Jewish people have been the most affluent in all their history. A time when Jews have money, big money. This is not a poor country, Israel. And the United States and Canada and the world, you know, and you look in the paper every day, Israel's buying up half of Europe. You know, about Bulgaria, Croatia, Slovenia, everywhere, you know, Russia. That's why the world gets nervous from us. You know, every you turn, you know, the largest apartment block in Berlin is owned by an Israeli now. So it's most affluent time. Now, what do we do with the affluence? It's a gift. I heard from the Ponovizier Rav, why is it the most affluent time? He told me as follows. He was such a person. And one of my great gratitudes to God is that I knew him and he befriended me. And for 4 years, every three times a week, I drove him in the morning. We went to see people. and was such a lesson to me in everything in life. See, he said to me, he said, if God forbid a parent has a child that's ill, very ill, Rachmona Litzlan, and the child is in the hospital and has to undergo, and it's very touch and go. And then somehow the child survives. So he brings the child home, the parent spoils the child, right? Buys toys. You want ice cream 3 times a day, here it is. We're going to go to the ball game. We'll do whatever you want, right? So he says, that's us and God and the Jewish people. After the Holocaust, and the Jewish people survived, so the Rabbeinu Shalom said, you want a state? Here's a state. You want to, you know, you want money? Here's money. You want to have influence? Here's influence. You want to be the vice president of the United States? Be the vice president of the United States. What an example. But then now the question is, what do you do with it? And that's the root of evil, right? That's the problem. And that challenge remains. And that's the entire thrust of the book of Mishlei, is somehow to enable us to deal with that challenge. To deal with the difficulties of having. There's difficulties of not having, but the difficulties of having. The Duke of Wellington said the only thing worse than defeat is victory. Because he says the ones that are defeated, they know what they have to do. They got to build themselves up and try and do it again. The ones who win, now what do you do? And that's our problem. We see it here in the state of Israel from day one. We're always victorious. But what do we do with the victory? How do we create something out of it? That's an enormous task. And I think that these are the ideas that make the book of Mishlei timeless for us. It's not a book that's studied often. But that's not a compliment to us that it isn't. And it looks, again, on the surface, very disjointed, just one verse after another, one idea. It looks like a mumble jumble. But if we delve into it a little and think of the ideas that are involved, it's the basic book of Jewish philosophy. It's what is intended to make us special in the world. And by realizing that and pursuing it, we have the opportunity, therefore, to grow into great people, and that the Jewish people generally have an opportunity to perfect ourselves, to be Yotzer or Lagoyim Nesaticha, to be truly the light unto the nations, and to have a holy and secure existence.